Hi, everybody. This is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind, WBAI 99.5 FM on your dial. Bringing new ideas, concepts, and guests to help you lead a more positively minded life. You know, part of what's so confusing about life is some of the stuff that we see right from the beginning. Right from the beginning, you know, right from the beginning we grow up, and as children we look around us and we try to understand what's happening with the people around us. Very often we look and we see and we don't know the difference, mind you, as a child. A child looks and he sees its parents in the house, and if you're an infant, you look at your parents and you see this is all you see. All you've seen is your parents and nothing else. So whatever condition they're in, that's what is normal to you. For example, if you grow up with screaming parents, yelling parents, you just think that's the norm. Like if you were a puppy and you grew up in a cave full of barking puppies and growling parents, you know, and growling dogs, you say, well, that's the way things are. Everybody growls and everybody is barking. Well, imagine you grow up, and in your world that you grow up in, your mother is depressed. And as you're growing up, you see that she's very, very sad and very, very stressed and very upset all the time. You think that that's the way people are. At least you think that's the way women are. You think at least that's the way mothers are, and you believe that that's the way mothers are supposed to be. And it's much more frequent than you think, depressed mothers. Yeah, you know, many mothers who go through this stress of this thing called motherhood, I mean, it may be easy for some, but it's a very, very difficult task. Very difficult to bring up a child, to be a mother. You know, very often they kid around and they would say to someone, what do you do for a living? And the woman would say, I'm a mother, I'm a stay-at-home mom. And people would kid around and say, oh, well, that's a big job. But how big a job is it? You know, how big a job? What are you supposed to be doing? You know, you're just taking care of kids. It means nothing. Well, it doesn't just mean nothing. We're going to have with us today, by phone, the author of a very popular book today called The Ghost in the House by Tracy Thompson. Tracy Thompson has written a book called Motherhood, Raising Children and Struggling with Depression. It's about the depression of mothers beyond postpartum depression. Now, we know about postpartum depression. When you become a mother, your chemicals go wild inside of you. They go crazy. You know, your hormones just are all over the place. And depression frequently comes along with those hormones right past childbirth. And that's expected. You know, people say, well, you know, you just had a baby. You're expected to be depressed. But we're not talking about that kind of depression only. We're talking about depression that goes far further than that, and maybe through the entire childhood and adolescence. And the kind of depression that many people see that almost no one talks about. Let's see. Are you with us, Tracy Thompson? Okay, we're getting her up on the air. She'll be with us in just a minute. This is Armand DeMille. Michael, do we have Tracy Thompson with us yet?
Yes, I'm right here.
There you are, Tracy. I thought it might be too difficult to get you on the air because you were attending to your motherhood duties.
No, my kids are at school right now. That's the only reason I can talk.
What exactly is maternal depression, and how is it different from the better-known postpartum depression?
I think of postpartum depression as a subtype of maternal depression. It's just one chapter in what can be a very long book. Maternal depression is, as I define it, is the intersection of depression and motherhood. It's where mothers, the disease of depression interferes with this all-consuming task that is being a mother. And it's also distinguished by the fact that it can be transmitted from mother to child via genetics, environment, learned behavior, or usually some combination of those three.
So it's not just one or the other, and it's not a mother being crazy. Genetics, you know, and then we'll take genetics, which is one, which let's say that for some reason your genes say that your gene pool was a depressed gene pool, which is possible.
Well, actually, it's a little bit more complicated than that. There's been some research out of the National Institutes for Mental Health, for example, that show that there's two types of serotonin transporter genes, the long type and the short type. It's like different styles of Buicks. They both do the same job, but they come in different styles. If you have the long type, you are no more subject to depression over the course of a lifetime than anybody else, which is, you know, you may have some chance of it, but not much. If you have the short type, your chances of being depressed by a divorce or a job loss or death of a parent or some other major life stress goes up like 3 or 4-fold. There is a genetic vulnerability, but it has to almost always intersect with something else.
Yeah, there has to be something environmental that goes along with the genetic predisposition
right.
to stress reaction.
Right.
So you could have the old short alleles or the short genes, right? And your short genes will mean that, you know, you're more likely to react. And that's why some people are more likely to react than other people to certain stressors.
Yes, I think of it as like having an electrical system that's prone to having blown fuses.
I wonder if they ever found any other correlations. Do you think, like, you know, certain color hair is more likely to react than certain color hair?
Obviously, you know, the genetics work has just really begun, and obviously there's going to be many, many genes involved. It's never going to be just one gene. This just happens to be an instance that kind of leaped out at them from the data they had collected in the course of doing some other research, actually.
So in a group of people, it is very likely that within the same group and the same culture, there's going to be a dozen women, and 6 of them will be likely to react to a stressor and not get depressed, and 6 will react to the same stressor, and they will get depressed not because they're weaker, but because they have the shorter genes.
I don't know if it would break down 50-50 like that, but yeah, there's going to be some subgroup that's going to have some genetic predisposition to be more vulnerable to stress.
And then on top of the genetic predisposition, there's your own family makeup.
That's
you know,
right.
What was your mother like? Regardless of her genetic makeup, you know, was your mom nurturing to you? Was your mom a little wacky? Did she support you? On top of that, what's your husband like? What's your family like? You know, what's everything like? You know, on top of that, what are your kids like?
Yes.
All of these become additional things that get to work on your mind. And as far as I'm concerned, if you're a mother who comes through it unscathed, you're pretty amazing.
Yes. I know women that seem to thrive on the stress of being a mother, but they're in the minority. I stand in awe of them. Most of us kind of muddle through.
You know, I always have my doubts about the mothers who thrive on the stress of being a mother. It's almost like they need their children to provide the stress.
Maybe so.
You know, I'm not so sure. How prevalent is this maternal depression among mothers today?
Well, that is a really good question, and the answer is I don't know, because nobody tracks depression in mothers per se. But I did some informed guesstimates. We know, for instance, that in any given year there are about 19 million people that suffer from depression. And since women suffer from depression at almost double the rate men do, let's say 12 of those 19 million are women. And then I went to census data that showed that roughly a third of all adult women have children at home under the age of 18. So let's say a third of those 12 million women are moms. So that would be 4 million women. And then I said, okay, suppose I just went wildly astray and grossly overstated it by a factor of 100%. even if you cut that in half, that's 2 million mothers out there in any given year who are struggling with a debilitating illness while trying to be good parents. And in contrast, breast cancer, which gets an awful lot of press these days, will strike somewhere around 200,000 to 250,000 women in any given year. So this is a health, public health issue that is much, much vaster than some other things that get a whole lot more publicity.
Boy, I'd look for correlations between the number of mothers taking SSRIs who are having prescriptions written for SSRIs and those who are buying Pablum, you know?
Yeah.
I'd say, all right, so how many of you are buying Pablum, and how many of you are taking SSRIs or getting formula? Okay, so what are you saying? Do you think that about one out of every five mothers is depressed? Which is what I think you just said in your statistics.
I think, yeah, that sounds roughly right, and that would be a broad description of depression. I mean, that could range from debilitating episode of major depression to kind of a minor, low-grade, chronic dysthymic condition.
Yeah, now an interesting thing about depression is being a therapist myself and seeing many women who come in who feel this depression, is they're not likely to admit this depression to each other. There's a kind of a pride in being a mother who does not admit her depression to other mothers. Isn't that true?
Oh, yes. It's like, as we were saying before, it was like tantamount to admitting that you drink once the kids are off to school. Admitting that the stress of being a mother makes you depressed is really tantamount to admitting you're a bad mom in the eyes of many women. To me, there is a huge distinction between loving your children, which virtually all mothers do, and loving the job of being a mother, which is a different thing. And like any job, some people are naturally good at it, and some of us are more challenged.
Yeah. It's more likely, you know, that the it's pretty primitive. It may just simply be that if you found out that I am feeling depressed, you know, you might go eat my babies or something like that. You know, it could be some kind of a primitive defense. I've got to show you my best face so that you won't attack my children.
Yeah.
So that my children are safe. It could be not even meaning to do it. I know a woman who ran these groups for mothers, and mothers would finally, in psychotherapy groups, talk about some of the depression that they felt, and they were deeply relieved to talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
Because just to be able to talk about it was such a relief for them. Because
mm-hmm.
It's so stressful, especially, let's talk about some of the challenges that a mother has to go to. And I want to say also, this is Armand DeMille with you at The Positive Mind. We're interviewing Tracy Thompson, author of the best-selling book, The Ghost in the House, Motherhood, Raising Children, and Struggling with Depression, which I think is an essential book for men. I think this is an essential book for men because men are screwed up in their relationships to women. And part of their relationship to women that gets so screwed up is their relationships with their mothers. And part of what they don't understand is what their mother went through. They have so much guilt and they don't know why. If a man could understand what his mother went through, without feeling guilty about it, but to understand this is the turf, this is the neighborhood, this is the way it worked, I think men would feel a lot more kindly towards this whole phenomena of motherhood and not feel like it's their fault and not blame themselves for their own and their mate's potential depression. And there are things that you could learn about this that could help a man be more supportive towards his own wife without having to do it from guilt or from shame.
Yeah, I think a lot of times men avoid this topic because, and I know my husband has expressed this, they feel helpless. They think they're supposed to fix it. And
uh-huh.
If they can't fix it, that they're somehow inadequate. Well, it's a pretty huge problem, and nobody expects them to fix it, you know, but somehow or the other men are conditioned to think that they're supposed to.
Well,
so,
you know, I don't know if it's so true, Tracy, that no one expects them to fix it. If I'm a depressed woman and I'm sitting in a house and I feel so screwed up and so overwhelmed and so overtaxed and I have a partner, there's a part of me that on some level wishes that my partner could fix it. You know, I mean, if you've got a car and you're out in the desert and you see a person who's just sitting there, even though you know the person can't fix it, you still wish they could. And that kind of, you know, that it's kind of conveyed,
Or you might just wish that they would stop and help you pass the time until a tow truck got there.
Okay.
You know, a lot of times what women want is to just ventilate their feelings. And a lot of times men interpret that, and I think this is, I'm basing this on research by Deborah Tannen and some of her books. Men interpret that as a fix this please request.
Yeah.
And in fact, women are not asking them to fix it. They're just asking them to listen.
Well, okay, let's say that a man is listening to a woman talk about the difficulties of her task. He goes out to work, and she talks about what she has to do in the course of a day. What's a typical woman's day from the minute she wakes up? Now, I know you do it in your book, and it's so beautifully done. From 8 o'clock in the morning when she wakes up, or 6 o'clock in the morning. Do you want to run through it? I'd love to hear you do it.
Oh, yeah. Well, there's a passage in my book where I talk to a quote-unquote non-working stay-at-home mother who was living in an upper-middle-class suburban Atlanta neighborhood. She gets up at 5 o'clock in the morning. She gets dressed. She empties the dishwasher. She makes breakfast. She has two elementary school-aged girls, so she gets the kids up. One of them wakes up happy and cooperative. The other one doesn't, so she has to jolly them into their clothes and getting dressed and fed, and their teeth brushed. If her husband is not going into work early, he'll help out. Otherwise, he's out of there. She then drives the kids to school, comes back home, walks the dog. She gets her own exercise in because for her, exercise is really, really key to keeping her depression under control. Some days she is a substitute teacher. On other days she does errands after her exercise. Then she does gardening. She shops for groceries on Friday. She cleans the house on Thursdays, on Tuesdays, and Wednesdays. She has brownie meetings at 2 p.m. She picks up the kids. Then there's snacks and homework, and then usually a play date after school. Then she has to fix dinner. She gets the kids bathed, gets them to brush their teeth. She reads stories to them. They do prayers. And somewhere in there, she does laundry. But
and
she doesn't work.
Right. And this is all during the course of a day.
Right. That's just a typical day. That's not a day with anything extra thrown in.
Now, you know, the way you say it, you said it like it was a job.
Mm-hmm.
Now, imagine we took that and you did it with the feeling that a woman has when she wakes up in the morning. I wake up at 5:30 in the morning, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I wake up and the first thing I've got to do is I've got to get dressed. You know? I have to empty the dishwasher and I have to get breakfast. I have to get the kids up. And then I've got to make sure that the kids are getting along okay, and I hope they're not going to be fighting with each other. Could you continue it in that vein, the way it feels?
You mean while you're depressed?
Yeah, when you're depressed, what does it feel like?
Then it's like, well, getting out of bed is an act of heroism. And then you think you're likely to have thoughts racing around in your head like, there's no point combing my hair. Nobody cares how I look anyway. The kids are fighting because you are distracted and withdrawn, and they want your attention. And when kids want a parent's attention, they fight, because that's a surefire way of getting attention. And so you end up snapping at the kids because the noise is unbearable. And you get them out the door because sooner or later that has to happen, but they go off to school upset and crying with, and unhappy with you. You drive home thinking...
How do you feel about the fact that you know that this is happening?
Well, then you know you're a rotten mother.
You know it. As you're getting them out of the house,
you feel like
a rotten mother who's
like
acting like a rotten mother.
Right. And because... But that's the best you can do, you know? They have to get to school, and there's no time to sit them down and say, kids, I feel rotten, and here's the reason why. You know, the clock is ticking. And so you get them off to school, and then you have to do these errands. And you are physically so fatigued that really all you want to do is go home and crawl back into bed. And you feel like your life is useless, and you're thinking, I wish I could just get in the car and just drive and keep on going to a place where nobody knows me. And, you know, you fight off thoughts like that all day long, and then you go through the motions. And you may even be able to laugh and make jokes with people because there is a social facade that we all can pull out of a drawer somewhere when we have to. But sooner or later, you have to deal with intimacy again. The kids come home from work. The kids come home from school. The husband comes home from work. You're dealing with homework issues. You've got to make sure that something nutritious gets put in front of the kids before they go to bed, so that they don't eat a dinner of Doritos and, you know, Kool-Aid. And all the while, you're thinking, my husband doesn't find me attractive. Why would he? I'm fat, dumpy failure. And, you know, by 10 o'clock, you're out like a light because the whole day has been physically and mentally exhausting.
And tomorrow starts the same way.
Right, right.
Wow, Tracy, that's beautiful. That is a very poignant description of what it feels like. I remember a number of different authors who come in who were able to talk about their own depression, you know, and when they talk about their depression, they talk about some of the feeling of it. Now that, imagine that feeling, and imagine that we each, probably, or many of us, could have been the child of that kind of depression. I imagine I might have been, you know, I mean, I don't even know, how aware could I have been of my own mother and what she went through? Do you imagine your mom went through anything like that, Tracy?
Oh, I know she did. I was the youngest child in my family, and...
How many kids?
Two. I have a sister who is 2 years older than I am. And by the time I came along, my mother had suffered postpartum depression after my sister's birth. And I don't think she ever really recovered from it. Back then, I don't know if they even used the term postpartum depression. Maybe they did for really severe cases, but in any event, my mother, it never occurred to her to go to a doctor or take anything for it. Not that there would have been much to take back then. And when I was a very young child, I remember picking up on her anxiety and her sadness. And I would keep asking her, what's wrong? You know, I just knew something was off. And because she was anxious, I was anxious. It was just in the air. It was like a virus. I don't remember wondering too much about whether other families were like ours. All I knew was that that was my world, and that my world had a lot of anxiety in it.
Did you ever feel responsible for it?
I suppose I did, yeah.
You know, I suppose I did, too. I suppose many of the people I've spoken to who have depressed parents... Excuse me, have depressed parents have said that, you know, on some level.
Well, that's the way children think, you know.
Yeah,
They're
sure.
The center of the universe, so it has to have something to do with them.
So here we are, most of us having grown up, and I think these statistics are even greater than what you and I make up when we say 20% of the people. You know, it seems to be there if they drop their face, you know. I wonder if that's why we have so many face lifts nowadays. Because there are so many fallen faces, you know. What are the main symptoms of maternal depression? What are the things that people can look for to help identify it?
Well, you have the usual symptoms of depression, which are pretty well known, I think. Changes in appetite, changes in sleeping patterns, feelings of guilt or worthlessness, inability to concentrate, feelings of hopelessness or despair, crying for no reason or crying for reasons you're not sure about. But in addition to the standard symptoms of depression, what I found in I did a survey along with Dr. Cheryl Goodman at Emory University. We did a survey that collected responses from nearly 400 women who were diagnosed with major depression. And two of the themes that emerged, well, there were three themes, actually. One was hyper-irritability, combined with a need to withdraw, and I see that as kind of a continuum, a cycle, because depression makes you want to withdraw, and yet when you're a mom and there are kids around, you simply cannot stay withdrawn. I mean,
so again, you know, that's kind of an interesting primitive reaction. In order to keep the irritants at bay, you have this hyper-irritability, you know, you kind of let people know that if you get too near me, I'm going to bite your head off.
Right.
And
right.
Then I could withdraw into my cave.
Right. And right? I'll come out if I have to.
I'll come out if I have to, but I'm going to bark. I'm going to bite you.
I'm not going to like it. And if you make me come out, I'm not going to be happy.
Yeah.
And then the third theme was a real, real difficulty in setting consistent limits for the kids. And that's linked with the hyper-irritability and the withdrawal.
Why is it? Is it because of the fatigue that comes with the depression?
Yes.
You can't set it. You can't set those limits because you just don't have the energy to set
the
limits?
Well, that's partly it, and partly is the cognitive issues that come along with depression, this inability to concentrate. Setting limits means that you have to remember from one day to the next, what's the rule about computer use?
Yeah.
You know? And if you can't remember, you can't enforce it. If you know that you say to your child, no, you may not have that candy, it's half an hour before dinner, and the kid is going to raise all Cain about it, and you just may not have the energy to fight that battle. And so you say, fine, go ahead.
Tracy, you've got to stay with us. Our guest is Tracy Thompson. The book is The Ghost in the House, about motherhood and raising children. We've got to take a short break. I'm going to play you some exquisite music for you, Tracy.
Okay.
And then when we come back, we're going to continue with this discussion here on WBAI. We'll be back with you in just a little bit. That's Rodrigo. Concerto de Aranjuez. Aranjuez. A-R-A-N-J-U-E-S. One of my old favorites. Guitar concertos. You could always, you know, our music that we play, we've got a new thing now. We have do. Which is we post all the music we play on our website. It's a new thing. Because so many people keep calling up and saying, what was that tune? So now through the good graces of Tom Gerby, who is mastering and keeping our website going, at the end of each show, we not only post the show for you to hear on the website, but we put the music that you heard so that you could actually fetch it for yourself. In case you like it, this is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind. We're talking about maternal depression. Why about maternal depression? Because, you know, this is the time of year when depression rears its biggest head. Moms who are doing their best to try to keep things going have to put out extra energy come holiday season. Oh, my God, do they ever. Putting up the tree and getting things ready. And trying to get, you know, the kids are home from school, and they've got to put out these extra efforts, and they got to light the lights, and the kids have more demands, and they've got to keep the energy going, keep the children entertained, and, you know, keep the husband somewhat happy. Things like that. And they've got so much to balance. It's remarkable. It's sad, actually. It's sad because something's gone wrong. Something gone wrong in our society that the support that should be there is not truly there. With the exception that they get a 1 o'clock radio program that they could listen to, maybe a 12 o'clock radio program that they could listen to also. They could listen to WBAI and say, all right, I got a good program I could listen to. With the exception of that, there's very little support out there for moms. There's very little that they could have that makes them feel not as alone. They could have friends, but very often you hide your depression from your friends. My guest, Tracy Thompson, has written the book, The Ghost in the House, Motherhood, Raising Children, and Struggling with Depression. Tracy's seen in her own life, as have I, what it's like to grow up with depression around you. Tracy, you're still with us?
Yes. I'm
pretty
here.
Piece of music, isn't it? Wasn't that pretty
music?
Yeah, I
love that music.
Yeah, it's lovely stuff. Yeah. Hey, Tracy, so maternal depression, we're talking about maternal depression. You said, you know, how can a mother dealing with maternal depression help their children cope with the mother's depression? Is there anything the mother can do to help her children help her or help cope with her?
Well, the absolute first thing you can do is to get treatment, because your health is vital to the health of your family, and you shouldn't feel like you're weak for having to seek help or anything like that. In fact, one of the mothers who responded to my survey said, I swear they should give you a T-shirt in every maternity hospital when you leave that says, whatever works. And I think that's a good motto. If you find that you're having problems with depression, you need to get, first of all, a thorough physical to make sure that you don't have some underlying physical problem that mimics depression, like a thyroid issue or something like that. And then if you need it, you need to get on some meds. Some medications which are not cure-alls, they're not panaceas, they all have side effects, but they can be valuable tools for helping you get hold of things and to get better. Not everybody needs pills either. A lot of times people are able, a lot of the women I talk to were able to keep their depression at bay as long as they exercised religiously. But sometimes even that doesn't work. I know of one mother who's a long-distance runner who is just avid about her sport and there are times when depression catches up with her no matter what.
She's not running fast enough.
Yeah, you can't run fast enough.
Can't run fast enough with depression.
Right.
But, you know, you seem to leave something out. The one thing that seems to make the big difference that we find here at the clinic that I run is that when a woman is able to release the serotonin that gets released when you have a contact with another female and you relax, when a woman can talk to a woman honestly about the way you feel, it releases the kind of serotonin that you get when you use a lot of the medications. So I have found psychotherapy or groups to be tremendously effective with mothers who are depressed.
Yeah, I would say that, but I would sort of offer something of a caveat, and that is that I've had traditional psychotherapy that was not helpful. I don't think it's helpful to sit around and talk about your depression and to analyze it and ruminate about it and to obsess over it.
Oh, I agree with that.
I do think it can be tremendously helpful to be in a mom support group and to have people there who know what you're struggling with, but who also help you keep moving.
No, I agree. I think the rumination may be a mistake.
Yeah.
You know, that ruminating and just going over it obsessively may be the mistake. Complaining about your stuff may be a mistake.
Right.
But being with someone who you can bond with,
right,
who can actually help you and move with you through different things and help you kind of talk about what the difficulties are and how you can get beyond them,
right,
that I think makes a big difference. But there you go through the skill of the practitioner.
Yeah.
You know, you look for the skill of the practitioner, and the way to find that is to make sure that you're with somebody who's experienced in the area that you're talking about.
That's right. And
you know, you want to be with somebody who's a mother. You don't want to talk to somebody who's never had a child.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not saying that person couldn't help you at all, but it's, you know, yeah, it's probably more likely a psychotherapist who is a mother herself might have some idea of what you're going through. On the other hand, a psychotherapist who's a mother who has always been more career-oriented and less domestic might not be a good fit.
That's right. And a psychotherapist with long genes may not be the right one. You know, you've got to ask them to show me your genes. You know, if you have short genes and you've been under stress and you've had to deal with that, you may be the right one.
Right.
Right. Right. But if you're somebody who says just buckle up and get past it, you may not be the right one.
Right.
So then we'll talk about medication or nutrition, you know.
Yeah.
And you talk about medication, mostly you're talking about the SSRIs, I imagine.
Yes, although there's a new drugs like Effexor, which is something that I take, are not SSRIs, and I forget the name of the class of drugs they belong to. I believe they act on other neurotransmitters besides serotonin. And more doctors are kind of prescribing a cocktail of drugs. I call it cooking without a recipe because everybody's brain chemistry is a little bit different, and you kind of tweak the dosages and find out what works for you. So that's what the medication is all about.
Well, but part of the difficulty with a lot of the medication, something that usually may survive in a relationship with a woman who's a mother, is as infrequent as it is, when you're depressed, somehow your sex may still be there. But, you know, when you start adding the medications for the sex, you sometimes lose that, and, you know, it's like a last stand. By losing that, I mean you lose a sexual interest. You lose all interest. Orgasm becomes something that becomes so far-reaching that a woman who is depressed but maybe have at least one little joy in her life that she and her husband can share sex occasionally, she loses that in addition because of the SSRI, and even though she feels a little slightly less depressed, but she loses interest in sex. It's like a double-edged sword, don't you think?
Or orgasm becomes harder to achieve. You can
yeah, and that becomes
right.
That just becomes another effort. You know, now we've got to try harder.
Right.
And
but there are ways to get around that too. There are almost always ways to tweak the dosage. You can take so-called drug holidays, where you don't take a pill for a day or so. Things that you can talk these things over with your psychiatrist and work it out. There's almost always ways to get around these problems. But yes, it always kills me when these drugs say side effects may include changes in libido, because normally what that means is numb from the waist down.
Which is what virtually it always is.
Some drugs are worse than others, but they almost all have some effect on the libido. But then depression has a huge effect on your libido, too. So you're going to be dealing with that one way or the other.
Having a group of mothers who take turns watching your children so a mother can have a real break one or two times a week and do something that replenishes herself can be really helpful, don't you think?
Yes. Joining a babysitting co-op, as your kids get older especially, most people think of babysitting as drudgery, but as kids get older and they start amusing themselves, at this point, my kids are now 5 and 10. Playdates for me are pretty much not exactly a holiday. I mean, I'm still overseeing things, but they take pressure off me because the kids are amusing each other.
What about the husband's role in this thing? You know, now let's take a look at the husband's role. We have the wife, right? There are a series of priorities in every relationship. And the priority when a couple is with a couple is the first priority is each other. It's a man and a woman. Their priority is each other. The priority is not the children. Your priority is your mate.
Mm-hmm.
That's your commitment. Then it seems that the priority becomes the mother to her children and the husband becomes the second priority. And he resents that on some level.
Yeah.
But behind her depression, you know, it seems like all the energy she has left is for the children and not for her husband anymore. He resenting that turns either elsewhere or gets angry at her, which adds to her depression. How do we deal with that? Do we give him some kind of drug to take also? Is that the way we're going to end this whole thing up?
Yeah, with everybody on drugs and everybody on therapy. I hope not. No, I think what helps very often is to make date nights a priority. And, you know, my husband and I do that. And we have a rule, an unofficial kind of rule. We can spend the first 15 or 20 minutes catching up with each other about the kids and about school and, you know, downloading, cross, you know, swapping information, things you need to know. And then after that, we have to not talk about the kids. We talk about things that are interesting to us. We talk about politics. And we try to reconnect with the parts of ourselves that made us attractive to each other in the first place.
Let's go over that slowly a little bit. No talking about the children after the first 5 minutes?
Oh, well, usually it takes longer than 5 minutes, 15, maybe 30 minutes, depending on what's going on. But you don't spend the whole evening talking about the kids, is the point.
There's a kind of a numbness that takes over when you start talking about the children over and over and over again.
Yeah.
You know, it's like gossip. You almost start looking for things to talk about.
Well, then you're not, it's more like talking to a coworker. It's almost sort of like shop talk instead of husband and wife communication.
I think one of the essential things when you have husband and wife communication is touch. That if you notice you're not having any physical communication with each other, even when you're talking, that there's no physical touch, that you're starting to go to that other side of the world, you know, where you two are not having the contact anymore, that you two are like dividing. So what's really important, even when you're talking about the children, is that there's some kind of contact between you.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just on the other side of the room. It's not just in passing.
Right.
And then when you finally do get down to remembering what it is you appreciate about each other and what you love about each other, that there is more touch. Because contact is what it's about. You see, the biggest gift that any man could ever give his children is to love their mother.
Yeah.
And the biggest gift that any mother could ever give her children is to love their dad.
Right.
That's the biggest of all gifts.
Yes. And sometimes, you know, our date nights, for me, a good date night would be just having a chance to lean up against my husband on the sofa while he watches football, and I make mm-hmm. irreverent comments because I don't like football very much. But, you know, just having the downtime, not having constant interruptions.
I agree. In the group of people that you're working with nowadays, are you working on a second book?
Focusing on the marital aspects?
Yes, is that what you're doing?
I could. I hadn't thought about it, actually.
What's been the response to this book, Tracy? I've seen quite a few articles appearing in different places. I know the Oprah Magazine, Red Book, Good Housekeeping, Washington Post. Then you did a book called The Beast, right?
Yes.
What was The Beast about?
That was about my own experience with depression, and that was written before I was a mother. It was written mostly before I even got married. And it was, I wrote it because I wanted people to understand that you could be really, really ill with this illness and still be very high functioning. I was a reporter at the Washington Post and holding down a pretty responsible job. And I just dropped out of sight one day, and the reason was I was in a locked ward at Georgetown University Hospital. And back then, the only thing that had been written about depression, well, there was William Styron's book, but I was concerned that people thought of depression as some sort of affliction of the artistic genius. And I wanted them to know that, no, it's just an illness, and it can strike anybody, and you can show up for work every day and have it.
Are you familiar with Andrew Solomon's book?
Oh, yes. In fact, I've corresponded with Andrew, and he is a wonderful person.
We had him here in the studio with us, and equally, from the inside, you learn so much.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just as you've taught us so much today, I want to thank you for being with us today. Tracy Thompson, the name of the book, The Ghost in the House, Motherhood, Raising Children, and Struggling with Depression. I'm sure you've given a gift to a lot of people, both men and women.
Well, thank you for having me.
It has been my pleasure. And this is Armand DeMille with you at The Positive Mind. Hey, friends, quite an interesting beginning to the week, don't you think? We've got some other interesting stuff coming up later in this week. We're expecting to tackle the issue of a depression that happens around this time of year. You know, it happens for a couple of different reasons. Not only is there holiday depression, but there's this light phenomena, this thing that happens as the light spectrum gets shorter. So we're going to look at that with a couple of different scientists who will be addressing it. I think Roberta Maria Atti will be back with us tomorrow at 1 p.m. as well. And just more and exciting stuff coming along. We've learned a few new things about science and what's been happening with science. They just discovered, this is in one of our latest research papers, that they could now tell which medications are most effective for you, which of the SSRIs, which are the antidepressants, by your taste buds. Yes, if you favor vanilla, then you're more likely to respond to Prozac than if you favor depression. If you favor chocolate, then you're more likely to respond to another Wellbutrin, and so on and so forth. And so they're finding that our bodies are an amazingly united thing. I mean, that's what it's all about. It's not about the chemicals, of course. Nobody wants to take them. Nobody wants you to take them. It's about how amazingly harmonious the human system is, the universal system is. This is Armand DeMille with you at The Positive Mind. I'll be back with you tomorrow at 1 p.m. Be sure to tune in then, my friends, and we will go out with a little special music for you.
Mommy. Mimosep, Camel, et on y va, et on y va. Oh, que toi, de tout et de yon, oh, que toi, oh, oh, oh.
Parisien du Nord, et jeune.